So it's a long lecture again, and I have limited time today, so I will go as far as possible in the time. And if we have to continue it next time, I will add the residual part, okay? So we had till now the first three lectures on MOVI, the basics. Then we had the charge exchange, how to get fresh energy into the engine and get rid of the old exhaust gas. Then we had the combustion. It's necessary to release the energy of the fuel. One in between, you should look it from the net. It's the efficiency, how to convert the energy of the fuel into mechanical work as well as possible. And now we are on the other side. Then let's say the consequences of what we have done. We have not only useful energy, but we will have pollutants created in the combustion, and what to do with it, why do we have them, and how could we reduce them is the topic of today, okay? So pollutant formation. You have seen already during combustion, there are some not desired side reactions during the combustion. There was, these two pictures were already seen. Here you can see mostly premixed gasoline, premixed combustion, but with some rich spots, with some liquid droplets and particulates. And the typical diesel combustion, the diffusion type combustion with a lot of glowing soot inside. So the reasons for the emissions, as one side, inhomogeneous mixture is always a disaster. We are intending to make it stoichiometric. So everywhere, every fuel molecule is surrounded with enough oxygen and exactly the right amount of oxygen to burn it. But it will not happen. So the mixture is somehow a little bit not 100% homogeneous. So you will have some lean spots and you will have some rich spots in the chamber. And both are providing pollutants we do not really like. So the rich spots will give you, because there's not enough oxygen, will give you some unburned hydrocarbons and more CO, carbon monoxide, because there's not enough oxygen to come to CO2. And the lean spots, it is more complicated. If they are slightly lean, they give us, unfortunately, a little more nitrous oxides. So it's, and then to be stoichiometric will be very important for the catalytic converter later on. Another reason, the insufficient time. So our internal combustion engine has only a very short time for the combustion. So we have short time for the mixture formation and very short time for the combustion. You could imagine if we had enough time and space, we could burn the fuel perfectly. No unburned hydrocarbons, but we do not have it. And it's a trade-off, because one side is a huge benefit that we have no continuous combustion. What do you think, why? We have a big, big advantage. We have only short time for the combustion. And it gives us a lot of efficiency at the end. It's a surprise. Why? Just imagine, with a stoichiometric combustion in the SI engine, the peak temperature is above 2000 C. What would happen if we have it continuously? Everything will be destroyed, melted, burnt, no chance. So what have you learned from the Carnot process? Efficiency is depending on the ratio of peak and low temperature during the process. So it's more or less a trick of the internal combustion engine. So we can go far higher than a steam engine or a gas turbine, because we have only a short time of this extremely high pressure, and all the components can survive, can be cooled in the time in between again. Okay? So it's a big benefit. So for compared to a gas turbine, we have a better thermal efficiency due to the higher temperature ratio. but we have a lower fluid flow efficiency because of the intermittent flow of intake and exhaust. So we cannot combine the two. So gas turbine is very flow efficient. You have a continuous flow, wonderful. You might have a high enough compression ratio, everything is fine, but you are limited in peak temperature because the turbine blades would melt. You can never run stoichiometric in such a device. The combustion engine has a very good efficiency in terms of temperature, but an intermittent flow, stop and go again, which will cause other losses. And inhomogeneous temperature, here you can see the temperature is pretty different, but even in the premixed flame, in the flame zone, you have very high temperature, before and behind lower temperatures. And you have seen during combustion, very high temperature will cause dissociation. The size molecules will divorce. Already CO2 in CO and OH, for example. And it's a source of other pollutants. So if we compare diesel, so CI and Otto SI engines, originally, in let's say 20, 30 years ago, we told these components, carbon monoxide, unburnt hydrocarbons, and nitrous oxides were common components, and diesel had an issue with particulates. Then we imported the efficient direct injection technology of the diesel to improve efficiency of the gasoline, and we imported the particulates as well. Of course, it's not only importing by direct injection, but this is one of the main causes. But the fact that the legislation is more strict and only a little amount of particulate is already an issue. It is on such a level that the particulate emission of a gasoline car is comparable with the particulate emission of an electric car, a battery electric vehicle. It's a surprise. What do you think, why? Can tell more. A lightweight BEV with a short range can be maybe 10% better than a Euro 6 gasoline car. A heavyweight large BEV is typically a few percent worse in particulate emission compared to a gasoline car. Battery is closed, hermetically closed. It will have emission during production, but it is let's say road-going emission, tank to wheel level. So all the production issues are excluded. No, it's a wonder energy, green energy, not calculated. On-site emission, going on the road. So the most people have no clue, and in the exhaust is so little particulate in the meantime, that the tire wear, the wear of the road surface, and brake wear are more significant than exhaust at Euro 6 level. And the electric car is heavier because of the battery and has more launch torque. Our experience, that the heavy BEV is emitting about 5% more particulates than a gasoline car. So we are at the dead end with city or urban emissions with cars. If we are using a car, it will provide particulates in let's say in a comparable amount. Diesel is slightly worse, but slightly, you will see there is only little difference in the meantime. But old cars are ugly. So we made some measurements. We picked some cars with a friend in Budapest from the parking place of the company. And new cars, there are so-called particulate counter. We have them in the department as well here. So you can measure the number of particulates in 1 cubic centimeter of exhaust gas. So a typical Euro 6 car will have maybe from 600 to 6,000 particulates in a one very small one, the micron size. in 1 cubic centimeter. The ambient air had on that day 3,500. So it means state-of-the-art cars are cleaner in Budapest in winter time than the intake air due to the particulate filter. An old diesel made in 1996 had 30 million. So in average, 30,000 times more pollutant than a state-of-the-art new car. So the bad news, and it's bad news for the European Commission as well, and they have these results, they know exactly from the scientists, that now to sharpen Euro 6 to Euro 7 and to make the cars even more expensive is absolutely useless, because it slows down the exchange speed of the fleet, and the old cars with the worst pollution are serving longer. So at the moment, the most benefit would be to kill the old cars. It's far better to remove one 30 years old car from the road than to replace 10,000 new ones from Euro 6 to Euro 7 or 30,000, which doesn't matter. So if we want to make a good business for the society, we would remove the old cars. About 10% in let's say in Hungary with the old cars, 10%, the oldest 10% of the fleet is providing 90% of the emissions in the city. So Euro 5, 6, we could forget it for a long time at the moment. Okay. So what is the difference between gasoline and diesel? If you see gasoline, the biggest chunk is CO, carbon monoxide. And there are some nitrous oxides and onboard hydrocarbons. Diesel is totally different because it's running lean. So the biggest chunk is unfortunately nitrous oxide. And they are the most expensive to remove them or to aftertreat them. Of course, there are some onboard hydrocarbons, and depending on fuel, might be sulfur and the particulates. The reason, you will see it later, but how do we create, for example, nitrous oxides? So the typical is the thermal NOx. The thermal NOx formation, the O2 molecules dissociate by breaking up free radicals, and they are aggressive enough to provide NO or NO2. NO2 is even worse. It's more stable and more harmful. So in gasoline engines, you will see in diagrams, the worst point for nitrous oxides is about slightly above lambda 1. Maybe I'm looking for the diagram. Okay, it's better. Sorry. This one. It's a gasoline engine running on rich or lean mixture. If you see the nitrous oxides, it's very interesting, because if we are going towards rich mixtures, it drops immediately, because we have not enough oxygen even for the fuel, and the fuel of carbon and hydrogen, they have very high affinity, so it's not enough oxygen for the nitrogen to be oxidized. On the other side, at lambda 1, if we are going above lambda 1, it increases a little bit, because we have more free oxygen not used for the fuel itself, but after it drops again, because with more and more air, we have relatively less fuel, and the peak temperature will drop. Because we have to heat up more air with the same amount of fuel, and if the temperature drops, the NOx goes back. If you look, CO is the easiest. In the region of lambda 1, it starts to increase, and it's increasing and increasing on the rich side, but it cannot disappear on the lean side, because of what I mentioned, you, this water-gas shift reaction, dissociation, some amount of CO is always existing in the exhaust gas. And strange is the onboard hydrocarbon. Of course, if we are on the rich side, there's not enough oxygen, it's increasing. It will have its minimum somewhere slightly above lambda 1, depending on engine and mixture formation, lambda 1.1, 1.2, somewhere is the minimum. And surprise, if we are leaning it out, it increases again. And it's not easy to understand what happens. And I will explain it later. The diesel is working from lambda 1.3 onward. So diesel starts in this picture on the right-hand side. So it is now the right-hand side. And you can see, if you are leaning out, that you are reducing the amount of fuel injected. Well, the diesel inhales immer the same amount of air, normally, without no throttle. So if you are injecting less fuel, the temperature goes back and the NOx will be less. The peak NOx is peak load. But, and the same with soot. If we are injecting less fuel, we will have less soot. Unfortunately, the hydrocarbons and CO, they can grow again at lean mixtures, because due to the very low combustion temperature, all the fuel which hits the liner, the components, will not burn during combustion. The temperature is too cold in the meantime. And that's the same reason for CO. Due to the cold temperatures, they are slightly rising again. But anyhow, the diesel has in total very little amount of unburnt hydrocarbons, and CO is not the issue. And it's easy for the after treatment, because in the exhaust gas you have enough free oxygen. So an oxidation catalyst would kill them. That is not the issue. The issue is the NOx, and I will tell it later why. It's the big issue. So, in gasoline engines, at the end we have to run lambda 1 because of the catalyst. So we will have pretty high amount of NOx, but the catalyst will reduce it in a very efficient way. If we are changing the spark advance, if we are reducing the advance, it will give us less NOx because the peak firing temperature will be less, less pressure and temperature. Unfortunately, we will be reducing the efficiency and the power. So it's a trade-off. Not very very reasonable method. What we can use and we do use is exhaust gas recirculation, even in gasoline engines, because if we add to the normal mixture additional exhaust gas, the mass of the fresh charge is the same to get the same energy, the same power, and we add the exhaust gas, we have in total more gas in the cylinder. And we are heating it up with the same amount of fuel. So the peak temperature can be controlled or limited with adding exhaust gas. And the reaction speed is somehow limited. So in the hot spot, in the flame zone, the peak temperature will go back, and the peak combustion temperature will go back due to the added mass of the exhaust gas. In diesel engines, the most efficient way is EGR, exhaust gas recirculation. State-of-the-art truck engines are running above 50% exhaust gas. It's a huge amount of exhaust gas in order to reduce the peak combustion temperature. So at the end, it's so aggressive, this technology, that we have to use more boost pressure, maybe double-stage turbocharging, to have enough air in addition to the exhaust gas in the cylinder. We are using extremely high boost pressures because we want to have the power which we had originally, but we have only 50% of the cubic capacity of the engine for the air, and 50% is used for exhaust gas. So it's depending on boost technology. Okay, and it is mentioned, but I show it. If we are retarding the injection, it will strongly reduce the amount of NOx because the peak temperature goes back. Unfortunately, it will increase fuel consumption and will increase soot. So it's the famous soot NOx trade-off of the diesel. So in normal diesel engines, conventional diesel engines, is always the dilemma that everything you are doing for less NOx typically increases soot, and vice versa. So it's like a balance. So at the end, for example, a particulate filter is important against NOx because it reduces the particulates, and I can go later with the injection. It's a very, very complex story with diesel engine calibration. Carbon monoxide, of course, if we have rich mixture, we will always have carbon monoxide because there is not enough oxygen. And this so-called water gas shift reaction, CO can split up in CO2, split up in CO and OH, unfortunately. And they will not find back on time at the end of the combustion. So it happens typically in engines cold start, because we have to enrich the mixture if the engine is cold. What do you think, why? I mentioned you the story with the vapor pressure of the fuel. In winter time, we need a high vapor pressure because the spark plug sees only the fuel which is already evaporated. And you inject the fuel into the cold engine, minus 20. Only a little amount of the fuel is evaporated, and the spark ignition requires lambda 1 related to the evaporated fuel. So you have to overfuel the engine for a safe cold start for the first few cycles, and the rest is unburned hydrocarbon. Sorry. So if you are measuring for the certification, a European car, at the end you will have some grams per kilometer, CO, HC, and all this stuff. And more than 90% of the unburnt hydrocarbons are coming from the few seconds the catalyst is not functional at after cold start. So this cold start overfueling and the low catalyst temperature after cold start is the main source of unburnt hydrocarbons. Later on, if the engine is warm and the catalyst is warm, we have no hydrocarbon issue. They are so easy to convert in the converters. The catalytic converter is not a real issue. Only cold start is a problem. How unburnt hydrocarbons are generated? Of course, the worst case is misfiring. If you have no ignition, the whole amount of fuel you injected is coming out unburnt. It's a disaster. And it's another disaster because you have a catalytic converter, the whole energy of the fuel will be converted into heat in the catalytic converter, and it will not survive very long. It will be overheated. So the engine management has to detect misfiring, and if misfiring occurs, it will reduce the power in order to save the catalyst. It's the fail-safe position of ECU. Flame quenching, I mentioned it already. The flame is coming to the metal wall. And if it's very near to the wall, the residual energy which can be released from the mixture is less and less. And the heat dissipation of the metallic surface is more and more. So the flame temperature goes down, and it will be completely quenched before hitting the metal. It's on one side very useful, because we will not burn the metal, we will not burn the oil, the loop film, and the liner. So it's very, very useful. On the other side, there will be a thin layer of unburnt hydrocarbons which can go through the exhaust after completing the combustion. And of course, inhomogeneous mixture, if we have rich spots somewhere, they will cause unburnt hydrocarbons as well. In case of diesel, of course, cold start is an issue as well. And adsorption on the surface and soot particulates, it's another story. During soot formation, you will see soot is like active carbon. Even you can buy in the pharmacy, if you have eaten something which is not healthy for you, you can eat some activated carbon, and it will adsorb then the harmful bacteria or poison or whatever. But it happens with liquid fuel and other products of the combustion. They will be absorbed by the particulates and will be transported into the ambient. And if the particulates are very, very small, below 1 micron, they can go through the cell membrane in your lungs. So they can in the blood. So it's not good. So we have to 100% filter the small particulates in the exhaust gas. So, easy story, unburnt hydrocarbons in a gasoline engine. Here you can see the combustion chamber in top dead center. And of course, the drawing is a little bit extreme, it's not the thick layer, but there is a thin layer of unburnt hydrocarbons sticking to the metal, and they will be spilled out during opening of the valve. Another mechanism, unfortunately, lube, oil, and fuel are strong or near relatives. So you can solve oil in fuel and vice versa. So in the thin layer of lube film on the cylinder liner during intake and compression, some amount of the fuel will be absorbed in the oil. And during exhaust stroke, it is hot, it evaporates again, and it goes out with the exhaust gas. It's unfortunately some storage device for a little amount of fuel, which will evaporate. And deposits, ash deposits, can do the same. There are some porosity in the deposits. It's not a solid material. And during compression, the fresh air fuel mixture will be pressed into the porosity. And after releasing the pressure during exhaust, it comes out again. And there will be some emission. So now, the worst situation, diesel combustion, diffusion type combustion. What happens in the first phase, some little crystals of carbon are formed. In next one, they start to coagulate and agglomerate, so like an avalanche. They are bigger and bigger at the end. And here you can see that only about 1/3 or less than 1/2 of the particulate is solid material. The other story are liquid and gaseous organic compounds. They are adsorbed to the carbon. And this is the real issue, not the carbon on its own, but all these materials, they may causing cancer or whatever. So all the strange products of the combustion are sticking to the particulate. And here you can see the surface of a carbon particulate. It's a huge surface and can absorb everything. The mentioned small carbon you can take for your stomach, one piece of that has a surface of a soccer field, active surface. So you can distribute a lot of harmful story on that surface. Unfortunately, it happens with the particulates coming out from the engine. So it is not harmless. Okay. And here you can see the same picture I mentioned, the diesel injection. Here you can see the swirl bends a little bit, this injection beam. Far away from the injector, liquid fuel will cause unburnt hydrocarbons. On the surface of the beam, the high combustion temperature will give us the NOx, and the middle of the beam, the rich mixture will give us the soot. It's the diesel dilemma. We have a lot to do with the exhaust gas. Yes, it's, you can see heavy oil burning vessel engine. It's really ugly. And it's interesting, if you are using, and heavy oil used in ships has a very high sulfur content, up to 5%. Not 5 ppm or whatever, 5%. And fuels rich in sulfur are causing a lot of black smoke. But even if they are running not on rich mixture. So, the good news, I told you all the bad news till now. You have a strong formation of particulates in the first phase of the combustion. Fortunately, the most of them will be burnt in the second phase. and only the residual amount at the opening of the exhaust valve is leaving the engine. And this is, we try to create a huge turbulence. This was the reason for earlier swirl chamber and pre-chamber diesel engines, and high injection pressure and high swirl to burn down as much soot as possible during the combustion. Okay, now here you can see it's interesting. One half of the picture is part of a movie, and the right half is a simulation. So computer simulation can give us a pretty clear picture in the meantime what will happen during injection. So all the combustion process is modeled, and you can see the glowing soot. Okay, this is the picture in detail. This is the injector nozzle with the holes and one injection beam. And here you can see the faraway fuel is unburnt hydrocarbon, the surface with the flame producing the NOx, and in the middle we are producing the soot. It's a multi-talent. And the reason for this famous soot NOx trade-off is this 3D diagram. If you see the combustion temperature in Kelvin, the air-fuel ratio, and the amount of soot, you will see that below 0.5, the soot increases rapidly. So if you are running really rich, below 0.05, it's a disaster. And the temperature, the worst temperature, is between somewhere 1600 and 1800. Unfortunately, above 1800, the NOx is increasing rapidly. So there is no space between soot and NOx formation in terms of temperature. We cannot go below 1600 because the efficiency is a disaster. And if we are going higher, it's a good efficiency, less soot, but more NOx. So we are now typically working in that area and try to find an optimum point between soot and increasing NOx on the other side. It's understandable. Oh, it's bad news. Okay, you have seen it already. And a few words to emission standards. It's the pretty variety of legislation. For example, if the United States is not the same everywhere. The West Coast countries have more strict standards. Canada is different. South America is different. The blue ones are somehow related to the European legislation. The most countries of the world are using it, but Japan is a difference. They have their pretty different own standards. So it's bad because if you are if you are developing a car and an engine, typically the emission legislation is so hard that if you are using the same engine in different cars, station wagon or shooting brake, whatever, you will renew the calibration. If you are using a different gearbox, you have to recreate the calibration. And if you are selling the same car in different countries, you need another new calibration. And it's a huge amount of money, so it's really crazy. You wanted to ask? It depends. For gasoline, it's more or less the same, but they had always the same figures for diesel than for gasoline, and it was not easy to fulfill. So now with Euro 6, is even in Europe very, very similar, the diesel and gasoline legislation. And it was the same in US, and you know, Volkswagen, but all other companies, even Ford, the American Ford, they all tried to cheat with diesel cars. But not all of them sold their cars in the US. So Ford, for example, is an American company. The diesels were on the same level technically, but they did not sell them in the US, so they was not necessary to pay the punishment. So emission standards. So the limited components are the unburnt hydrocarbons, the carbon monoxide, the nitrous oxides, and the particulates. And there are several different limitations. At the beginning, only the total particulate mass was limited. And later on, the particulate number as well, in order to avoid very low, small diameter particulates. And in some legislations, they're soluble, it means liquid and gaseous components of the particulates are evaluated separately. So it's very, very complex. So I know here you can see the history of Euro 1 to 6D temp. So the particulate number, for example, is coming with Euro 6B at first. Earlier there was no legislation. And here you can see the rough figures. CO is coming down. NOx is coming down. You can see more than 10 times less in the meantime. And particulates as well. And for diesel engines is slightly different. CO is less because it's easy to fulfill. And you can see particulate matter is not more visible in the meantime. And it's so strict that it's even hard for gasoline engines. And even the Weir particulates of cylinder liner and piston rings are already visible if you are measuring particulates in exhaust gas. So just to have an imagination, what are we talking about? This experiment we made with used cars, after the measurement of one old car, we had to clean the unit for one day because it was more or less dead, the equipment. So just imagine 30,000 times more particulates in an old diesel than in a new one. 30,000 times. So one old car can produce as much smoke than half of the fleet in Europe. Okay, and the history of cycles. Of course, the driving cycle was standardized very early, how to measure the car. And this is a very famous new European driving cycle, NEDC. It was used for more than 20 years. New European drive, and it still was the same name at the end, more than 20 years. And it was originally a city cycle, just to launch the car in first gear and stop it again, first, second, stop it again, first, second, third, and stop it again several times. So stop and go city traffic, because it was the worst for emission. Then later on, a highway cycle was added up to 120 kph. And the test was with gradient. So the acceleration was defined in a way that every car could fulfill it. So it was maybe hard for a Cinquecento, and it was nothing for a Ferrari. Okay, so the big difference. And it is not okay, because nobody drives a Ferrari like the Cinquecento and so on. And the only valid measurement was if you control the speed of the car in a very narrow band around this line. So in other words, if you were running 130 on the motorway, there was no emission legislation. There was no emission legislation. Of course, it was not allowed to switch down all the devices against emission, but it was allowed, for example, in order to protect the catalyst against overheating, to overfuel the engine, and the evaporation enthalpy of the fuel cooled the exhaust gas and cooled the catalyst. So the worst engine I have seen had an air excess ratio, it was American car, of lambda 0.67, overfueling to cool down the exhaust gas. So 33% fuel unburned, emitted, according to low emission vehicle legislation, because in the cycle there were no high speeds. So it's crazy. Then worldwide harmonized light duty test cycle, WLTP, was introduced. And it's far more dynamic. It has at least slightly above 130 kph, so even the motorway is in. And after all the dramas with exhaust gas, the rear driving emission cycle was added, which looks like this. You can go into the traffic with the car, and the driver can do more or less anything. and it has to fulfill all the prescriptions. And because of this test, overfueling is not more allowed. No chance. So with Euro 6 D-temp is the first legislation which is really useful, and from my point of view is absolutely enough today. So all the simulation results show us that a stricter Euro 7 would be a disadvantage because of the slowing down of the exchange rate of the fleet. So at the moment is not a benefit. We all hope that it will not be very strict, because it makes the cars only more expensive and not cleaner. So it's the amount of, let's say, in Budapest, for example, in typical Eastern European cities, no other component of the exhaust gas is an issue, only the particulates. There was never any smog alarm in Budapest because of other components, only particulates. Okay. Yes? It starts, but only in a so-called emission-controlled areas, ECA. It's like the English Channel or the Singapore Narrows. So in areas, they are there are cities and very narrow. So narrows where many ships are going through, and near to crowded or inhabited areas. On the open ocean, there is nothing. There is nothing. So these vessel engines are optimized for efficiency. What does it mean? High peak firing temperature. And 50% of all anthropogenic nitrous oxides are coming from vessels. So not only traffic, all human activities, including industry, agriculture, traffic, everything together, 50% of the globe's nitrous oxide emissions are coming from the vessels. Dolphins are not voting. So it's sad, it's really sad, but it is today's business. It's a disaster for the planet. On the other side, I have no time today for it, but for example, the Sentinel satellite, the European Sentinel satellite, could deliver nitrous oxide pictures, for example, from Europe. And I have seen the last one. The most of the NOx is not coming from the cities and from the cars. So the really hot spots of NOx are always the thermal power stations, coal and natural gas power stations. In Europe, more or less three countries have no NOx issue. It's France, Switzerland, and Austria. They have no thermal power stations. So we try to solve everything with the cars. I mentioned Budapest. Less than 10% of the particulates are coming from cars. 60% is coming from household heating. If we are looking the very harmful below 2.5 micron particulates, in Hungary, 85% is coming from household heating. So we cannot solve it and fix it with cars. Even if we stop all the cars, we will still have 80% of the particulates. And if we replace all the cars against electric car, the Euro 6 car replaced by an electric is the same amount of particulates. And it's very important, if you have heavy transport on a road, we can measure more particulates. But one very important reason, the moving vehicles, independently from the driving force, the moving vehicles are keeping the particulates in the air due to the turbulences. So they cannot go down. So by then not producing them. Of course, the mentioned old diesel car can provide the amount of particulate for 30,000 state-of-the-art modern cars. So two old diesels, provide as many particulates as all other cars endure. It's really crazy. So heavy duty, it's interesting. So the passenger car tests, as I mentioned, they were not very well designed. In the meantime, they are better. Heavy duty was really good. If you look, they were measured not on the chassis dyno, but on the engine dyno. And the really high load points, 100% load, because all the trucks, if are going uphill, they are pushing the pedal really through. So they are running on high loads, and high loads are really measured. So this is far more reliable, and they were always pretty okay, the truck diesel engines in Europe. And they have a transient test. It's really very transient, and you look theoretically, they might drive 80, but the test knows all the companies are using the tolerances, and the trucks are going really so 87, and the test is created with that speed. It's an absolutely realistic test, not that the cheating opportunities like the old European driving cycle. Okay, called new one, but it's the old one. Okay, it's not necessary. So typically, we are measuring the emissions on a chassis dynamometer with a very special instrumentation, which will dilute the exhaust gas in order to avoid condensing water and to feed this exhaust gas in a huge plastic bag. And at the end, the plastic bag will be analyzed after the end of the test through an analyzer, and all the amounts of grams of hydrocarbon CO is then measured. So the beginnings, the first standard for diesel engine was the so-called Bosch Schwertzungszahl in German. You had to pump with, at the beginning it was a mechanical, a hand operated pump, to pump some exhaust gas through paper filter. And you had in a book a scale from white to black, gray colors, and it's Bosch 2.5. It was the measurement device in the 60s, even the 70s, and as I guess early 80s, it was the usual Bosch blackening number. Okay, now, okay, we will manage it. How to reduce emission? Of course, the best way to create a clean, good combustion to avoid the formation of pollutants. So to homogenize the mixture, to use a small surface to volume ratio combustion chamber, a well-positioned spark plug, injection timing, or pre-injection, so split injection strategies and so on. There is a lot of opportunities. In this picture,
it is not functional.
It doesn't make sense. And for example, there are strategies how to feed exhaust gas into the combustion. Of course, you can have an external EGR, so you have simply a tubing and the check valve from the exhaust back to the intake manifold. But you can use, for example, variable cam timing in a way that you have a big overlap of the valves, and during the valve overlap, exhaust gas is coming back from the exhaust directly. So, and it has different effects. Is now I will not ask it in the test or examination. It's just for information. It's very interesting. So, for example, you can go with a higher percentage if you are using direct internal EGR. But the external is reducing the NOx stronger. Why? Because the external EGR can be cooled, and if it's cold, it has more effect on peak firing temperature. Unfortunately, it will increase unburnt hydrocarbons stronger, but it will reduce fuel consumption stronger. So it's the trade-off in diesel development. It was always a 10-dimensional space to find the optimum. It's a disaster. So normally, the optimization of diesel was made since 20 years computer-controlled and not man-made, because the human brain cannot find the right spot in this 10-dimensional space. injection amount, injection timing, split injection, amount of EGR, boost pressure, and all these figures together. So here you can see the effect of EGR. Only 10% EGR. The red color shows the higher combustion temperature. This is 2300 K. The lowest one is 1700. 10% EGR reduces the peak temperature in a dramatic way already. Just imagine 50%. It's an extremely efficient tool. And it's complex. Do you want to understand it? Okay. So the simplest way to reduce NOx is to retard the injection. If you retard the injection, you are going, how to explain it. So if we are retarding the injection, the NOx will go down. It's zero EGR. So we are starting with, let's say, 11 grams, retarding the injection. And we can reduce the NOx to nearly 6 grams. But we increase the BSFC by 20 grams. It's a disaster. So if we add 10% EGR, we are starting already with a good fuel consumption with 7 grams, and we can go back to 3 grams. With 20% EGR, we are starting with 3 grams, and we can go back below 2. You can see that EGR helps to keep the fuel consumption. And at the end, we started with 9 gram NOx and ended up with 3. And with this more or less the same fuel consumption, or even less. So this is the smart or intelligent way. This is the benefit of EGR in a diesel. Okay, and there are some fantastic devices. It's just for information. For example, variable compression ratio with a strange mechanism. And the benefit, if you have a turbocharged gasoline engine, you can run a very high compression ratio during part load, and you can reduce it for full load without retarding the spark as much. So you can shape your combustion in a better way, but you can imagine this mechanism is extremely heavy, expensive, has a lot of friction, so it's always a trade-off. Nissan uses it. It's the Infiniti concept. And other device, to support the after treatment system is somewhere in between. Sporty engines has very often an issue because for good charge exchange dynamics, you cannot put the catalyst directly near to the cylinder head. So need longer exhaust pipes, and the heat up time of the catalyst is too long. What to do? For example, you can overfuel the engine. You are going below lambda 1 into the combustion, and you pump some fresh air directly behind the exhaust valve into the exhaust port. Behind the exhaust valve into the exhaust port, it is hot enough to ignite the amount of fuel and heats up the catalyst faster. So large sporty engines has very often this device, this secondary air pump. Now, and maybe one of the most important messages. If you look the exhaust gas composition, 78% of the air used to be nitrogen. In the exhaust gas, still 71. And most of the exhaust gas is inert gas, is nitrogen. You have maybe 13% water vapor, 14% carbon dioxide, about 1% oxygen and other not harmful components, and maximum 1% harmful one. And it's, in case of a gasoline, The most of it is carbon monoxide, easy to trade, some particulates, unburnt hydrocarbons, and nitrous oxides. This will be the issue. And what can we do? CO can be oxidized. HC can be oxidized. NOx must be reduced. It's not easy. We have to do very, very different things to the same time in the same spot. And the particulates can be filtered. But after filtering, at a certain time, we have to burn them down because the filter is clogged. There's no more flow possible. So how to do this? Originally, the gasoline engine started with a simple oxidation catalyst, which could trade the high amount of CO and the HC, and there was no improvement in NOx. But at the beginning, it was not a question. Later on came the three-way catalyst. It's a very interesting device. It can trade to the same time in the same volume, can oxidize HC and CO, and can reduce NOx. Then for lean engines with a so-called stratified charge, it's a special story. If you want, I can tell a few words. The beginning of direct injection was created in order to achieve stratified mixture. The idea was to have the benefit of diesel. It's not necessary to close the throttle as much, so we can avoid the throttle losses. We want to run, instead of lambda 1, lambda 2, or 2.5, or maybe 3. And this is a big advantage in fuel consumption. Unfortunately, in the lean mixture, we cannot trade the NOx with the three-way catalyst. So there was a special catalyst, the NOx storage catalyst, or lean NOx trap, in the other wording, necessary. It's very expensive and will increase fuel consumption. Or we can do the same with the SCR technology, widely used on diesel engines today. This selective catalytic reaction, you need this famous AdBlue additive in the car. And together with AdBlue, this SCR catalyst can trade the NOx. And at the end, we need, in the meantime, even an auto particulate filter for the gasoline engines as well. That is the full range of after-treatment methods. The diesel started. It is funny, because in Europe, the politicians had to make some legislation, and there was no other technology available. The three-way catalyst was not functional on diesel because of the lean mixture, so they prescribed an oxidation catalyst. It was more or less useless, as a matter of fact, or maybe even worse, because there was a little CO, it was traded. There was a little HC, it was traded. Unfortunately, this oxidation catalyst produced from NO, NO2. So it increased the amount of more harmful NO2 at the end. But politicians are free in their minds. So it was prescribed for a long time. And then there was some experiments. There were some experiments still in use, the lean NOx trap, the NOx storage catalyst, for smaller diesel engines, and is widely used, the SCR technology for powerful, strong diesel engines is the best technology. And of course, in the meantime, the DPF is standard. With Euro 4, it became standard. It was very interesting, the story. Euro 4 was achievable without filter, but the French company Peugeot introduced the first DPF. It's funny, it was developed in Germany. A German competitor of my company did it for them. And the German press was so excited that they forced the companies to modify their engines. They were fulfilling Euro 4, but without filter. So they all had to introduce the filter because of the pressure of the publicity and of the press. At the end, we did not know to that time, but it was a good idea. Because it's funny, the particulate filter filters the smallest particles the best. So it's not like a mesh that the small ones can go through. It's just the opposite. The small ones will not go through. And they are the most harmful, the smallest particulates. So it's a very good idea at the end. So a catalytic converter. A catalytic converter is typically a huge ceramic surface with a huge active surface coated with some amount of precious metals, platinum, rhodium, and so on. And these metals are providing some wonder. They can cause, that, for example, coming out hydrocarbons and oxygen, they will burn already at lower temperatures. So it's not necessary to ignite them with very high temperature. Above 300 C, it's typically already functional. So you need low activation energy. So the oxidation catalyst at the beginning, they just traded Cu and Hc, and it was only necessary that the mixture was at least lambda 1 or above. So if you had enough oxygen, there was no more issue with Cu and Hc. It was the clear function. Cu was oxidized to CO2, and Hc was oxidized to CO2 and water. It was a very, very simple story. And now there came the wish and the legislation to trade the NOx as well. And the three-way catalyst was invented. And it's very, very interesting. It will oxidize the Hc and the CO the same way. And to the same time, it will take away the oxygen from the nitrous oxides. And now the question, how could it work? How does the catalyst know the gas is flying through with 100 kph? And, oh, you are NOx, you will be reduced. Oh, you are CO, you will be oxidized. How does it work? Have you any idea? Any idea that it's more or less impossible? Hmm? Could be a good idea, but it's not the case. There's one homogeneous loading of a combination of precious metals.
It's like when we put oil in water and the oil will...
It's so turbulent. It's perfectly mixed.
And that these components react with those precious metals?
The precious metal is necessary to have the process at lower temperatures. But they cannot distinguish what is what. We are closing. It's magic. It's really magic. It was simply necessary to run stoichiometric or a very slightly, not even at a tenth of a percent below stoichiometric is the best point. And you can see what happens in the catalytic converter. The conversion of NOx is more or less stable on this side, because what converts NOx? Or other way around, it's easier. CO, you cannot convert it on the rich side because there is no oxygen. Okay. So if you are running rich, your catalytic converter will not convert Hc and CO. It will be fine on the lean side. And it will convert pretty well on the rich side, the NOx, and absolutely not on the lean side. Why? Because not the converter is reducing the NOx. You need a reductant, and it is CO and Hc. So the mixture. You have to be sure that you are running lambda 1. And if you are running lambda 1, you have enough Hc and CO in the raw gas, in the feed gas, to take away the oxygen from the NOx. And in the very moment you are running lean, you have not enough Hc and CO in the feed gas, and you cannot reduct because you no reductant, nothing which would eat oxygen. So simply Hc and CO, they have a higher affinity to oxygen, and the catalytic converter allows the oxygens to divorce from the nitrogen and to go to CO and Hc. But you must have them. And it's only functional in this very, very narrow point. And of course, it was a challenge how to be sure that your engine is always running on stoichiometric. You might have different air pressure, temperature, humidity, uphill, downhill, and so on. So a special sensor was invented this so-called HEGU sensor in British, or lambda sonde in German. And it's a funny material invented by a German guy, Nernst, as it's a zirconium oxide material. And it's very interesting. If you are heating up zirconium oxide and both sides are in contact with different oxygen concentration, an electrical tension will occur between the both sides. Just imagine somebody made some experiments in the laboratory to heat up zirconium oxide and to put different oxygen concentrations on both sides. It's crazy. But somebody invented it. And this lambda sonde gives you a significant electrical signal in the vicinity of lambda 1. So now is the only necessary story to play around with the mixture, to enrich it a little bit, to lean it out again. And the lambda sonde, if the signal is moving up and down, you are in the range of lambda 1. So these sensors are linked to the ECU and telling exactly, even if it's cold or hot or what happens, they can adjust the original map of the ECU and to adjust the amount of injection to plus or minus that you have always stoichiometric mixture. Of course, it's complicated. We have wide range, but with this sensor, this sensor will deliver only a signal directly at lambda 1. And in order to control, for example, an engine with a lean mixture, the stratified engines, there was necessary to develop sensors with a wider range, below lambda 1 and far above lambda 1. And it was a trick. The same zirconium oxide has another capability. If you put an electrical voltage on it, it starts to deliver, to pump oxygen ions from one side to the other. So now we are doing both at the same time. So there is this layer of zirconium oxide. One side is in the exhaust gas, other side is in contact with the fresh ambient air, like in the other probe. But now putting electrical voltage on both sides, it starts to transport. So you have the equation between transporting oxygen from one side to the other and incoming exhaust gas. And these two will give a wide range of signal. You can tell it's lambda 1.7, it's lambda 0.9. So this sensor will deliver always a signal. You can, the classical lambda HEGU sensors has 1 to 4 lines or cables. The wide range has 5. If you see a five cable or five wire HEGU sensor, is always a wide range probe. And now the last trick. You have a HEGU sensor in front, upstream of the catalyst. And as I mentioned, the ECU will vary the mixture, and the control sensor delivers this signal. In US, there is no TÜV, no survey of the cars, they are already sold. The company who produced the car has to guarantee that the exhaust after treatment system is functional all the time. How to do this? You need a sensor on board which will detect if the catalytic converter is gone, if wrong, and the yellow light on the dashboard goes on, check engine, going into the workshop, to the garage. And the trick, people realized, if we are putting another HEGU sensor, a downstream sensor after the catalytic converter, the catalytic converter will smoothen this signal. So we are varying the air excess ratio. It varies on this sensor, but behind the catalyst is a straight line. And if the catalyst is not more functional, this variation will occur on the backside and on the downstream side as well. So at this very moment, the check engine light goes on. And now it's the responsibility of the owner that he reacts and, okay, my catalyst is gone, I have to go into the garage. Okay. And DPF. The today's DPFs are wall flow filters. It's like a catalytic converter. Maybe you can see, you will see such a mesh of porous ceramic material. And every second opening is blocked. So the exhaust gas flows through the wall and leaves the filter in the other pipe. There were at the beginning, for example, in Germany, some aftermarket filters, so flow through filters, and some particulates were trapped by accident. Of course, it was necessary because this filter, if it's clogged, you cannot drive the car anymore. The exhaust pipe is blocked. So before it happens, you have to regenerate the filter, and it happens in a thermal way, typically. You have to increase the exhaust temperature in a range that the suit will burn down and the filter is free again. This one, it was not the case, but nothing happened. If it was full, it was not more functional, but the next German motorway was good enough to burn down the suit and it worked again. So it had an effect of 20 to 40% reduction in particulates. This one is nearly 100. Of course, there were some crazy ideas for regeneration. For example, in commercial vehicles, there might be a huge flame device, the burning flame to burn it down. The original, what I mentioned from Peugeot, the original filter, it was regenerated with an additive. There was a liquid in a separate tank, which added some cerium. It's a metallic compound, like a catalytic liquid, to the exhaust gas, and it helped to reduce the self-ignition temperature of the suit. And now the most important, how does the filter works? So you have three effects. So the smallest particulates are trapped with diffusion. They're just going with diffusion into the material of the filter and sticking in the filter. Some particulates are intercepted, like I mentioned, it's a mesh, and the particulate is bigger than the hole in the mesh cannot go through. And the largest ones will stick on the filter like flies on your windscreen. They are just going onto the filter and they are trapped. So what happens depending on size, here you can see the size of the particulates in microns. This is here. 1 micron, 1/10 of a micron, 1/100. And you can see the diffusion is given with the smallest particulates. 100% of them will be trapped below slightly less than 1 micron. The impact are the largest ones. Only the very large ones are sticking on the surface like flies on the windscreen. And the interception is somehow not real. The interception is AR. This one is working with the large ones. So if you add all three effects together, you will see that this area is E0, is the total amount of particulates trapped. You must be careful and must design the engine in a way that this size will not be produced. So today we are trying to produce the small one, the most harmful ones, but they are trapped 100%. So it's so complex to have a well functional diesel particulate filter. And it's very interesting, and sometimes we have good luck. Here you can see the exhaust gas temperature and the burning down intensity of the suit. And normally, if we have the normal exhaust gas, we need about 550 C exhaust gas temperature of a diesel car to have automatic so spontaneous regeneration. It means over speed and load, it's full load and higher speed. The German motorway 200 is the only area where automatic regeneration will occur. So since that we need some special measures how to increase this burning down. But good luck, I mentioned that the oxidation catalyst increases the amount of NO2 in the exhaust gas. And we were not very happy with that at the beginning. Now we are absolutely happy. Just have a look. You have, or if you have enough NO2 in the exhaust gas, the self-regeneration temperature comes back by 150 to 200 C. And typically, since that, we are building a diesel engine in a way. The first is the oxidation catalyst. It will increase the amount of NO2. Then comes the particulate filter, and it's today combined with the SCR catalyst I will explain later. But the benefit, both the DPF and the SCR are working better with some more NO2. So we are doing something wrong at the beginning, and in the end we have good luck, because the second step of the after treatment enjoys the benefit of more nitrogen dioxide. It's the only point I can tell you engineers might have some luck. So it's not necessary this one. So at the end, we end up with a diesel engine. It cannot be operated with lambda one, with stoichiometric mixture. So we still have the NOx issue. So it provides more NOx, and we have no after treatment device. So we invented two. One is the so-called NOx storage catalyst. There is some alkali earth metal mixed into the catalyst, which will bound the NOx for a while. Still it is full. And then we have to start the regeneration cycle. It means we have to add fuel. The fuel can take away the oxygen from the NOx. It will cause fuel consumption, of course. But what are the differences? The other one is the SCR, this AdBlue method we are mostly using in Europe. It will add some urea water mixture. At the end, we need the ammonia to reduce the nitrous oxides. So both are working pretty well, efficiency above 90% is fine. The operating temperature range is a little wider with SCR, so it's positive. It starts earlier and can work at higher temperatures and can survive higher exhaust gas temperatures at high engine load. So it's good. Fuel consumption, okay, we need a lot of fuel for the regeneration, several percent increase in fuel consumption, and nearly nothing with SCR, only a little back pressure increase, so it will cause a very slight increase of fuel consumption. But we do not need the additive. And this additive, this SCR, is cheap, is nothing. Urea is the main component of P, of any animal. So it's not an expensive stuff, but it has to be refilled. And the disaster was that all the European companies knew the American driver is only prepared to refuel the car and nothing else. And they did not want to build a large enough SCR tank that it is has the capability to survive one oil exchange interval, so 20 to 30,000 kilometers. So they reduced the consumption of urea in order to overcome this issue, and this was the problem. And all the companies did the same. Unfortunately, Volkswagen had the poorest lawyers. So every car consumed, so the same size car, typically 1 liter urea on 1,000 kilometer, and we would need about 3. Shit happens. So the next one, here we have to modify the ECU, because the regeneration mode requires extra fuel. But how to add extra fuel in a diesel? If I inject more fuel, it will accelerate. Okay, it's an issue. They do not want to accelerate. I want to increase only the exhaust gas temperature. So it means I have to deteriorate the engine efficiency. How does it happen? Late injection. So I can retard the injection, or I can use some post-injection near to exhaust just to emit the fuel. And the fuel will reduce the NOx stored in the catalyst, but it's extra fuel consumption. With the SCR, is no influence necessary. I need just a signal from the ECU, regarding engine speed, load, and temperature. And based on this, I can calculate how much NOx is coming. And I can define how much AdBlue I have to inject. Another issue, this is not, if the engine is running continuously on full load, I cannot regenerate the filter anymore, the NOx trap anymore, but I can do it with the SCR system. Of course, the space requirement, I have only the catalyst, and I have the catalyst, the tank, and the dosing system is far more complex and more expensive to build in. How does it work? The NOx storage catalyst, I guess, is one of the best pictures. There was the Volkswagen FSI. It was the stratified gasoline direct injection engine. And just imagine the engine was running 60 seconds lean and 2 seconds rich. In these 2 seconds, the stored NOx was removed or reducted in the catalyst, and then it started to run lean again. It looks like this. You're running the car at lambda 1.4 lean for 2 seconds rich, and another 60 seconds lean again, all the time. And it's crazy, and then you see the amount of NOx stored in the catalyst going up, you regenerate, going up, you regenerate all the time, every minute. And just imagine a state-of-the-art engine. This engine had an electronic throttle body, had a turbocharger, had EGR, adjustable camshaft, and of course, electronically controlled spark and injection. In order to change the lambda from 1.4 to 0.8, you have to adjust simultaneously the throttle position, the boost pressure, the cam timing, the EGR, the amount of injection, and the timing of the spark. In a way that the driver will not notice any change of engine performance. So the full programming of the ECU till exhaust certification was about €2 million. Just the programming. €2 million for one version car and engine combination. So we stopped it. Nobody produces stratified engines anymore. And now the SCR catalyst, it was originally the technology of power stations, huge industrial boilers and power stations. Here is the flue gas of the boiler. There is an ammonia tank, liquid ammonia, an evaporator, and compressor which blows the ammonia with pressurized air into the exhaust line. And here is the huge selective catalytic reaction, SCR reactor, which has an active component of vanadium pentoxide. And with this technology, following happens. As I mentioned, you have the oxidation catalyst at the beginning. It will increase slightly the amount of NO2. Now the whole stuff is coming into the SCR catalyst, and you are adding AdBlue. AdBlue is urea and water together. So in the first part of the catalyst happens the hydrolysis. The urea will be, it's NH3. I have to the copy of a picture is a wrong one. I will get ammonia, what I need, and CO2. So from urea, the carbon is burnt to CO2, I do not need it anymore. And the ammonia will react with NO and NO2 in a way that at the end I will have only clean nitrogen and water. So it's not yet ready, because if I did not dose enough urea, I will still have free NOx in the exhaust gas, and we are very hard with the limitation, it will not work. If I am dosing too much urea, I will have ammonia in the exhaust gas, and it's poisonous and smelly, and it's not allowed to emit. So how to solve this issue? And if the engine has a varying load, it's a big issue there to calculate the reaction time and so on, so it will not work. So normally we are dosing slightly more urea than necessary, and at the end there is an oxidation catalyst which will burn the not necessary ammonia into nitrogen and water. then this one is working all the time on your car. And today is typically combined with the DPF. This is one bottle, one ceramic mesh, and has the active material for the SCR technology and has the porosity for the filtering effect. It's one unit very often. Okay. Few minutes for the questions. Socrative test, we cannot do it today. I have to postpone it for next time, okay? Why do emission gases form during combustion? Okay. More precisely, it's not bad. Yes, why? Because of, there were two or three main reasons. Because it's uneven. Okay, near to the wall, yes. Well noticed. But the general statement at the beginning was we have a not even temperature distribution. The cold zone gives us more CO and HC, the hot zone more NOx. We have a not perfectly homogenized mixture, inhomogeneous, rich and lean to the same time. And the time is too short. Have not enough time for perfect mixture formation and combustion. Okay, these are main reasons. In gasoline engine, which lambda value do we have the highest NOx formation and why? And which in a gasoline engine, which air excess ratio gives us the most NOx? Below one, you have not enough oxygen even for the fuel. Speak up.
1.1.
Why?
Because that's where we have plus oxygen too.
We have already free oxygen, yes. And the temperature is still high enough. If I'm going beyond, above lambda 1.1 or 2, the temperature starts to drop. Even if we have enough oxygen, it's not hot enough for burning nitrogen. On the rich side, we have simply not enough oxygen for it. Okay, very good. How does the increased compression ratio, affect the amount of unburnt hydrocarbon? It was very interesting. We are always targeting high compression ratio for a good efficiency. And we had to learn, if we are increasing compression ratio of a gasoline engine, we will end up with more unburnt hydrocarbons. How could it be? It's tricky, but not impossible to find out. How do we increase the compression ratio? What do we change in the engine? We are making the combustion chamber smaller, okay? If a body or a cavity becomes smaller, the ratio of surface to volume will be? Exactly, we have more surface related to the volume, and this effect of this thin layer of hydrocarbons is more and more at the end. It's crazy, it's a surprise, but it happens always. And even as we changed the material of the cylinder head from gray cast iron to aluminum, it cools better, so we can use more compression ratio, but due to the colder surface of aluminum, we have more hydrocarbons. Better fuel consumption, more power, but more hydrocarbons. Okay. What are the NOx emission reducing methods and how do they affect the formation of other pollutants? Okay. what was the two main button to adjust NOx or to reduce or increase NOx in the engine? Diesel. Okay, it's outside of the engine. In the engine, it's after treatment. So the formation of NOx. What do you do with the injection time? If we advance the injection, you will have more power and less consumption, and NOx is going up because you will have more peak firing pressure and temperature. So if we're retarding the injection, we will have less NOx, more consumption, and more soot. And it's the famous soot-NOx trade-off. Everything which cools helps the NOx and makes more soot and vice versa. And the other is exhaust gas recirculation. It's similar, is not as bad for soot formation, like the retarding of injection. And fortunately, but it is increasing soot as well. But it is not deteriorating the fuel consumption, at least. It's the big benefit. How does the injection time change if we double the injection pressure? Okay, it's a typical question, just general engineering. You have an orifice of the injector, and you want to have the same amount of injection in case of double pressure. You are going from 1,000 bar to 2,000. What is the new injection time? Half, so it's linear. Square of what? VB one fourth or the Bernoulli equation. There was velocity square. Okay. So if you increase double the pressure, the flow will go up by the velocity square will so double flow requires four times the pressure. So if you double the pressure, the flow goes only up by square root 2. 1.41. So if you want to have the same flow with double pressure, you have to reduce the injection time divided by square root 2. Not the half divided by square. Okay, you understand it.